Space Oddity.
Yeah, welcome to the new episode of Space Oddity. Today it's a workshop episode, and we're just reflecting on the past 2 days of workshop we had on the 25th to 26th May in 2023. The topic of the workshop was quality of space, different meanings, conflicts, and solidarity. And this workshop was jointly organized by the DICE, which stands for Department of Social Science and Economics, Sapientia, University of Rome, and the CSC 1265, Refiguration of Spaces. The workshop theme followed the understanding that spaces have qualities, the unfold meaning about which we can argue, but which also can generate solidarity. We will reflect the cooperation between DICE, Sapientia, and the CSC, as well as we are going to focus on the past workshop discussions about the social consequences of different spatial qualities under conditions of refiguration, asking what quality is and why sociology needs a definition of quality of space, with being aware that there doesn't exist a normative definition of quality. So I have two guests who joined me today, and both contributed also in the last 2 days. And the first guest I want to introduce you is Letizia Grazia Fasari, shortly Lia. Nice to see you here. Welcome. And she's the head of share of cultural sociology and sustainable cultures at the Department of Social Science and Economics at Sapienza University of Rome in Italy. She has been a guest researcher in 2014 at the Department of Global Studies and Language at the MIT in Boston, USA. And she visited us here already at the CSC in October 2019 until March 2020. And her key research focuses are hovering around the performance studies, sociology of space, social aesthetics, post-colonial theory and studies, as well the sociology of the imaginary. And she also participated along our second guest on the upcoming volume Considering Space, which is going to be a part of the CSC 1265 for outpledged series Refiguration of Space. And other guests who participated is Dominik Badmanski, and he holds an interim professorship for general sociology and cultural sociology at the Department of Social Science at Humboldt University of Berlin, and has been also a fellow of the Heisenberg Scholarship since 2020. He earned his PhD in 2011 at Yale University, USA, and habilitated 2019 at TU Berlin. He joined the Institute of Sociology at the Technical University of Berlin in 2015 as a research associate, and has been since the inauguration of the CSC 1265 a part of the research center, and was also a former project researcher and is now an associated member. His research focus are cultural sociology, social theory, urban ethnography, urban design, and music sociology. So thank you for your time and patience after all these 2 intense days of theoretical workshop and also empirical workshop. I mean, there were so many different presentations, but let's focus first on the history between how this cooperation and this joint organization of the Sapientia, or the DICE Sapientia and the CSC, evoked.
Hi, Christopher. Thank you for having me in this podcast. Well, it starts with this visiting fellowship. When I met Martina Luth in Rome, we recognized each other, this openness and curiosity, because going around Rome, I was trying to show her the less touristic part of the city, and we talked about spaces and place and how spaces are produced and how people create space and all these differences. And I was talking a lot about Sicily, where I was born, and Rome, and how Rome became a place for me. I had never been to Berlin, so I was really interested in her stories about Berlin. So it comes naturally that I came to Berlin at the center. And I consider it one of the most interesting experiences of my life because of the international environment, many projects on a global scale, transdisciplinarity, and a lot of young people involved at different level, very dynamic place. And what I can say, Berlin was, of course, love at first sight.
I mean, being from Sicily, moving to Rome is also a change, sure. And how you compare Rome to Berlin? I mean, when you had this shift and you, I mean, you had a different, or you had an image actually of the quality of Berlin, probably.
Let's say this, Rome is, the beauty of Rome is front stage, is just like that. It's so immediate experience. Berlin is as an unseen but tangible quality. So it was very interesting for me to discover the quality, Berlin quality, and I really love this city. When I come back, I feel to be in a place to be.
But could you maybe say a little bit about tangible? What do you mean by... Because this is very interesting. You mentioned that Rome has this front stage beauty, which I guess probably connects to the idea that it's also a certain performance of a city which is very self-conscious of its value for tourists, for example. We talked about it during our workshop. And Berlin is not necessarily exactly like that, or maybe not exactly in this kind of category where very classically understood beauty is kind of put on show for people who come and take selfies in front of it. Right, it's more about experience of Berlin, and perhaps this is what you meant when you said that, you know, there's some tangible quality. But if you could maybe elaborate a little bit on that, because I think this is quite at the center also of what our workshop was all about. Yeah. What kind of quality we have in mind, and what constitutes quality of places such as cities, and what different notions of quality we can have or should have.
Tangible for me is to have these structures which help, but which facilitate your life, especially as a woman, which have a family, for example, or just the idea that you can reach a place very fast, very soon. And also this idea that crossing the city, it's easy, so you can experience any kind of neighborhood with all the variety, and any neighborhood in Berlin has his own story. So it's really tangible, this. Of course, in Rome, you have this, it's much more imaginary, the beauty of Rome, than tangible. Because you always, when you see ruins, and ruins are, of course, hybrids, because there are past and present. And also you have these ruins in the million way that also with these plants. So it's an atmosphere that sometimes this atmosphere doesn't help you to live the city in a contemporary way of life, you know, does match a lot contemporary way of life. That means also to reach your purpose every day. So it's a little bit more provisional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Last time I visited Rome was like a decade ago. And to be honest, I don't have any image, which is actually from my own perception anymore, of from Erlebnis, let's say, like this. Because we had this frame in the past 2 days, Erlebnis, which is actually quite hard to translate into English. And maybe of our German listeners will get the clue between Erlebnis and experience. But my image from Rome, because you were telling its quality is not so tangible.
I'm from Sicily, but I really love Rome. I can't live without the beauty of Rome. What I'm saying, just to give you an example, when you go out to Rome, maybe you have to change your plan because something suddenly happens in a street, or, you know, you are late, and also maybe you have a plan during the day and you have to change. And this is not necessarily bad. I mean, could be our style or or we are the result of this provision, no, imprevedibilità, I don't know.
I mean, it forces you to improvise.
Yeah, improvise.
And maybe exposes you simply to surprises that maybe, you know, maybe unpleasant sometimes, but also pleasant in some unexpected way.
Yeah, this is the weak point, and but also the strong point of Rome. And in Berlin, you have this tangible. I really like this structure of Berlin. It's easy, it's clear, it's fluid, but at the same time, there is a lot of dynamization. There is a lot of people from all over the world. There are a lot of things to do. You can see Roma, when you talk about Roma, you talk about spot. And also, it's Roma. It's a very lively city,
and also an art place.
Yes, it's about pace and space and historical. And also in Berlin, you always stay in just in the middle of the history. So, if I think very well, there is not. I mean, it's paradoxically, but there is not so this great difference. We are in two iconic place.
That's true.
And that make the difference. Very iconic Rome, very iconic Berlin. So we share this unicity.
This is actually very interesting because I think this brings us to the importance of symbolic value of places. When we talk about cities like Rome or Berlin being icons, we can always think or ask the question, icons of what, right? And I think you gave us already a good sense of how they are different, but they are similar in this function of being icons for something. They stand for something. And especially the example of ruins is fascinating because if you don't know history, you cannot really fully appreciate ruins. We appreciate them, we approach them in a particular way because we have knowledge of antiquity. Even if rudimentary, we still have that knowledge. We approach these ruins with the knowledge. So ruins as, you know, specific physical structures are wrapped in all this semiotic universe that actually makes it fascinating, right? This is the icon of antiquity. And antiquity itself stands for so many different meanings, the beginning of Western philosophy, Western law, and so on and so forth, right? You can associate all kinds of meanings with it. And I think that function of iconization, how places iconize something, that definitely adds to quality of the place, I would say, isn't it?
I agree with you. And thinking about Rome and Berlin and their similarities as iconic cities, I think that what is different is just the experience of fluidity in Berlin, which is very easy to cross, which is very easy to navigate, and Rome, which is the more difficult because of we can't build an underground. But of course, a unique piece of antique art or a tomb or something. Yeah. So it's impossible to build an underground. Rome is so strong that signs your rhythm of life. Mm. You can decide to overcome the rhythm of the city. So it's another experience. I'm not saying that one is bad, one is good. It's different in that iconicity. It's, as you say, very similar, but the experience of the city, it's very different.
I think it actually emphasizes one important aspect of how we can conceptualize quality of place, that it's not just some sort of intrinsic property, but rather something which is constituted relationally by contrast, right? So we understand specificity or quality of a place like Berlin by relation to other cities such as Rome, for example, and vice versa, right? We evaluate Rome, let's say you are from Rome, you live in Rome, and you have a certain understanding of a native inhabitant, so to speak, right? But then traveling somewhere, visiting another place, refreshes your perspective. introduces awareness of contrast, similarities and differences, and precisely those relations, that kind of relationality that enables us to perceive contrasts, right, brings us closer to the general definition of quality, but also appreciation of specific quality or qualities in plural of a place. We can see what is maybe great and not that great in contrast to something else, right? It is this contextuality and relationality and network of comparisons between different cities that actually, you know, leads us towards an understanding of what city, sociologically speaking, is. So at a certain level of generality. So we have one concept which is applied to many different structures, sometimes vastly different, and we still use the word city for them. And at the same time, it enables the appreciation of specificities, what it is about Berlin that we can define as its quality, let's say, in a sense of something valuable, unique, specific to this place.
Yeah. And also talking about our workshop, what Martina at the end, in the conclusion, says was that quality is relational because it come up from all the contributions. Relational quality and the idea that quality is strictly related to a process is not just an attribute. It's, as you say, situational, and also is very, we have to link it to process. So quality is much more to related to made quality, being the process to, as Angela said, qualifying.
And maybe also in this sense, somehow I'm thinking about it refreshes your perception somehow. It changes your perception. There's this saying that the grass is always greener on the other side. And it's meant mostly negatively, that this is some error of judgment. Oh, you think it's better, but actually it's not so much better. But setting the question of better or worse aside, I think that this saying actually tells you something. Like, you have an impression that the grass is greener on the other side. So if you put evaluation for a second, the normativity of it aside, you actually discover, let's say, a phenomenological aspect of it. Precisely because you see something else, because a difference is introduced, you have a sensation or a feeling that the grass is greener on the other side. And this itself can be, in some sense, valuable, right? Can at least sensitize us to the fact that there are perceptible differences, there are phenomenological differences, and regardless of whether something we think is really absolutely better or absolutely worse, simply the perception of difference is already valuable and sociologically interesting.
Yeah, I also appreciate a lot your and Gunther's contributions against this, when we talk about quality, against this material or symbolic reductionism, and the idea that quality emerges from the connection, the alchemy of that connection, that is something that creates, we can talk about atmosphere or something that it's... we perceive through senses and through body, first of all. What do you think?
Absolutely. The sensory aspect, this was our intention, to emphasize the sensory aspect, experiential aspect. Christopher mentioned this difference between Erlebnis and Erfahrung that is visible in German terminology, which I think is very useful. Unfortunately, cannot be really perfectly rendered in English. We provisionally translated Erlebnis as a situational experience that you go through in a particular moment, in a particular situation, and an Erfahrung, something like an experience that you have had, or the moment you say, I have experience, is, you know, an act of synthesis.
Yeah, it sounds to me like a closed process. Like,
exactly.
Kind of, it's, you're talking about the past. You have like a situation and you went through, and then you have an experience, but it's also the process to think about the situation.
Exactly. Maybe.
And the Erlebnis is, from my perception, also more effective, actually.
Yes, it is more effective. It's more sensory. It's maybe something that we speak in terms of present continuous time. I am talking right now. I am sitting here. Whereas Erfahrung is expressed in present perfect. I have understood this and this about life. Right? So, and the moment when there's this translation from Erlebnis to Erfahrung, the moment when Erlebnis and Erfahrung somehow also get synthesized in us and in our discourses, we can talk about the definition of quality. This is where quality emerges. But there's also, I guess, another understanding possible here, namely how quality is not something which is merely an intrinsic property of a setting, of a place, right, of a neighborhood or a particular site, but rather, you use the word atmosphere, it is an emergent property, which means it is not simply a sum of parts of environment that are somehow there and additively create an effect. The emergent quality is a whole which is bigger than the simple sum of its parts. And I think that this is the alchemy or the mystery, as you phrased it, of quality in the social sense or quality in a phenomenological sense. And I think also this is the moment when these things become intellectually tantalizing and interesting, right? Because we're not simply talking about something mechanistic, something additive, something bigger, which I think is not an alien way. Sometimes people think, well, maybe phenomenology is not particularly useful because it's subjectivist and we try to be intersubjective and objective. Again, setting this debate aside, I would say we constantly use general categories. For example, culture. This is a big composite category that, of course, somehow is bigger than its parts. We can distinguish perhaps elements or factors or parts that we think belong to the definition of culture, but would we say that this exhausts our understanding or good sociological definition of what culture is? No, it's something bigger. It is also an emergent quality in exactly the same way that language is an emergent phenomenon that doesn't belong to anyone and it's not reducible to any individual act, speech act or text, right? And exactly, Foucault also talks about discourse in this way. It's a collective property. It's an emergent property. And I think that this is also something that creates a fascination, I would say, with sociology and cultural sciences, the rights, as you would say in German, about those things. This is where I think also the quality of sociology is, right? That it actually uses those concepts, which are not just simple descriptive concepts, but they try to sensitize us not only to the existence of a different level of reality, but also usefulness of that different level of reality, usefulness for thinking, usefulness for understanding. I don't know, Leah, what you would say about it, but sometimes I think that this is maybe what we could take from this workshop and thinking how quality is something more, that it's not reducible to any one element or dimension of our experience of social reality.
Yeah, I completely agree. And also, for example, we talked a lot about smell and sound, that is, of course, near atmosphere is something that is emergent in emergence suddenly in a place, in a space where when you cross the street, and this is a change in your perception of quality, change also how you think quality. But what it was interesting also as outcome of this very dense workshop was seeing quality from the margins, which doesn't mean exactly is to try to put ourselves in other positions and just have a look how people with a particular situation, for example, people that don't have a home, homeless, perceive quality. What is quality for them? How they produce quality in their space? Quality is also related to this visibility and paradigm of visibility and invisibility. As you already said, quality is very related to perception, is also situational, is body related, is an experience, first of all.
I think that experience is really a quite crucial category that perhaps has not been explored fully in sociology that had in its, you know, rich tradition, a certain kind of rationalistic bias, methodologically speaking, a discursive bias. And then there's an interesting irony here that although sociology prides itself on being an empirical science, it actually doesn't have a very good conception of experience, especially bodily experience. And I think that this is maybe what our workshop could offer and sensitize us to the importance of experience.
And also experience is a combination of different logics. It's not one logic. Because in experience, you have the logic of subjectivation, so you have the logic of community to belong, the logic of belonging, but you also have the logic, the strategic logic, how to reach purpose or how to compete or some thought experiences. As you see, it emerges from the combination of these different logs.
And this is what we also tried to kind of return to in one part of our talk with Gunther, when we talked, for example, about goal-oriented and value-oriented, Zweckrational and Wertrational, which are, of course, ideal types. And oftentimes these logics are also mixed in particular situations, in particular experiences. But perhaps, since we've been talking about the importance of sensory experiences and senses, perhaps we could also say that every sense has a slightly different logic, in a sense that visuality, for example, operates differently than touch. And I think the experience of lockdown, when we were all separated, made it very, very clear. There has been a lot of talk about it, how, well, you can work remotely in a sense that, you know, transmission of visuality is easy with our technology today, but touch, no. It's not possible. And maybe we lose something when we are not in place together.
Yeah.
Maybe listening to DJ mixes online is not exactly the same as being in the crowded club listening to the same kind of music. Musically speaking, the content is the same, but the experience is entirely different.
Actually, I was also really wondering the last 2 days. We were really focusing on the visual aspect of reception, and then we... Or later in the workshops, the smell emerged, and the sound was a quite dominant topic also. And I was actually always questioning why nobody talks about tactile experience. Mm. Also, like a spatial experience is highly constructed by a tactile perception.
Absolutely. And there's a growing awareness of that. Of course, there's a fantastic book by Constanze Klassen, which is called The Deepest Sense, The Cultural History of Touch, that tries to reconstruct the importance of touch, but also how it has been talked about and used in research. I think we don't have enough of these publications yet. But if you look around, you really see that that reflection has been scattered all over humanities and social sciences.
A lot was about space and affect, affecting space or affectivity, affects and space. And of course, these include tactile, include sounds, include smell, include the way, Nendelesianen, we influence, are influenced by others. And there is also a lot of otherness in sociological tradition and knowledge, like, of course, race, class. They are all affective dimensions. And I just want to add that another topic that is the big frame, it was about, because we start this workshop trying to contrast the reductionism in thinking quality in the neoliberal paradigm, where quality was safety, was identified with safety, security, munitas, all these things. Also to think quality after refiguration, as Angela said. What is quality right now? And a lot was about hybridity. Hybridity. Nowadays, a contemporary life is very much related to hybrid. There are not duality anymore in, for example, cultural, natural, let's say, material and symbolic. So, you know, we have to think quality in this new experience of life.
I was questioning right now, like, because we're referring to, like, a change in the last couple of decades, probably, which also is the reason why we're talking about quality right now. Do you believe that the needs also changed of the people and therefore the qualities? How is it connected?
I mean, psychologists would say that there are certain fundamental needs that don't change, right? Which somehow belong to the makeup of what it means to be human. There are certain fundamental needs, right? And it was like that in ancient Rome when the ruins were not ruins, but a full-blown city. And it is the same now. But it's at the same time obvious that there are new needs, certainly. And our understanding of what it means to be fulfilled certainly evolved in all kinds of forms. And I would also venture to say that we just have incredible multiplicity, incredible plurality of those different needs. And also that many people are now aware of that plurality, maybe to an unprecedented extent. There's a new form of awareness of what other modes of life can be. In the past, if you were stuck in some unfortunate, sociologically speaking, unfortunate position, this also meant that your awareness of the outside world was probably quite circumscribed. Today, obviously, we also have that kind of problem, but we might say that general awareness of plurality, of modes of life, is perhaps greater. And that contributes to that general awareness of plurality is greater, and that contributes to the perception, right, that we have new needs, that maybe we have multiple needs. Martina...
Consideration needs, probably.
Absolutely. Martina, I think, in several different conversations that we had, emphasized that to her, late modernity is very much connected to a sense of ambivalence. And I think that this is... that the late modern condition is an ambivalent condition, which I guess is somehow related to hybridity and perhaps also this perception of, you know, there's so many different things out there that I might want to experience, in a sense of I have different needs. Sometimes they can be conflicting, and in this sense I will experience ambivalence. Sometimes they may be in harmony with each other, but definitely there is this plurality and multiplicity. I would say that that's part of the situation today. I don't know, Leah, how would you connect it to what you named hybridity? These are obviously not, it's not the same.
I want to say that in 1933, Le Corbusier, in a proposal for the future city of cities, made a sort of classification of human activities around four urban functions like work, residence, leisure, and transport. Now it's really, really difficult to think around this. It doesn't work anymore because our lives is not as separate. At the moment, air, water, energy, and the earth have become artificial, humanized, and politicized. So this is what hybridity is. But our thinking has to be around the hybrids of technologies, animals, plants, humans. Mm-hmm. That's what hybridity is. We can't think about the urban space like residential areas, office, nightlife, leisure district, or whatever, because subjectivation, it's in late modernity. And with this old paradox of narcissism, all kind of this, but it's very strong. And also, I really agree. And now there is, even in a communicative dimension, there is a proximity between people. People know what others do. Sometimes there is a very terrible distance of, let's say, sociologically speaking, positions, but a strong proximity. Mm-hmm. And that's made society more affective because there are more resentment, there are also more sharing imaginary.
Definitely. I mean, it's almost a commonplace right now, especially with our media landscape.
Mm. Yeah.
Sharing, exchanging, communicating massive amounts of data and imagery. Everything is so heavily mediated right now that this is certainly the case, which of course leads us to the question that was being posed at some point yesterday in the workshop: to what extent any discussion, sociological discussion of quality, must include phenomena of mediatization?
Yeah.
Right? Can we actually approach, you know, a topic, let's say, of urban quality from the traditional point of view, where maybe, you know, media effects could be at least partly bracketed? Probably not. Some sort of a fusion of classical sociological and morphological architectural analysis wouldn't do anymore, because the perception of reality, especially with young people called digital natives who basically grew up with these devices, their perception often can be such a line separating virtuality and reality. It is not as clear as it may seem. What's happening in virtual sphere may have a greater ontological presence and force than what supposedly is taking place in so-called real reality. From that point of view, of course, the evaluation of what quality is, the definition of what quality of a place is, maybe quite different. And I think we have to reckon with that. Obviously, we all do. We are all part of that to a greater or lesser extent. But sociologically speaking, the questions of mediatization, or what Hubert Knoblauch describes through his communicative constructivism, speaking about social construction of reality, that seems unavoidable and necessary for sociological discussion today.
You are right, absolutely. So now we try to do is to, after this dance workshop, to take a little time of thinking and quietness and to try to explore all this complexity, because I think that a new and more reflective idea of quality needs to be drawn, not in a normative way, because all our workshops were all based on ground, or and this is the sociological specificity. We are not philosophers, so we really made all this observation through empirical case, because as Gunther with us, there is a quality that is normative that we can talk a lot, but is a quality which emerge from the ground that is really important to don't forget. What we can say also is that in one sense could appear as tautological, but the quality lies in the ability to produce quality. And this is, of course, a problematic and opaque sentence, but it's as we can catch that there is something through in that.
I think this is actually a quite intriguing and potentially useful formulation, because I think it shows also maybe usefulness of thinking about quality as potentiality, not necessarily only as actuality. When we think about actuality, there is a tendency to think, okay, that kind of situation or context means or causes this to happen and has this quality. And so there's certain determinism lurking there. And I think we have a sense that again, that kind of mechanistic understanding doesn't really reflect what's happening. And speaking in terms of potentiality, quality that is conducive to emergence of other qualities, speaking in terms of something that is relatively indeterminate, can happen but doesn't have to happen, contingent, potential, I think that this is a very, very useful, a very productive way of thinking about not only quality but many things. And in fact, this is the usefulness of the concept of affordance. Instead of talking about, you know, in materialistically reductionist way about some material qualities or material properties that cause this or that to happen, or mean for sure, supposedly this or that. Rather, we talk about bundles of qualities understood together as affordances. An affordance is a setting that enables something to happen, can be used or this or that, that makes it, lends itself to certain classes of uses, but doesn't determine the use, doesn't specify that it must be this way or it will be this way. There's a certain degree of openness to interpretation, openness to use. And I think that speaking in terms of potentiality, speaking in terms of quality that opens up possibility for other qualities, speaking in terms of affordances, that's a very productive way of framing sociologically what quality is.
Yeah, so this was probably an intense discussion, but the clock is ticking by and I have actually two hungry faces sitting next to me. Maybe we will end this discussion now. To sum it up, quality is a relational category and often referenced. And of course, this process is processual action. So it's not fixed and it's not from one point possible to observe. So you have to go by time also. What I also get from this discussion that it's won by linking, so it's always by linking different objects, subjects together, And of course, we talked about a lot of about perception. And in the end, it seems like it's subjective, but maybe there's some intersubjective aspects of quality. But we have to research on this, and I'm curious what will happen in the next couple of years. And thank you a lot for your time and your presence.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Chris.
And yeah, we hear us the next time. We see us. Goodbye.